Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. In this audio, I'm going to cover Isaiah chapter 5, which I will entitle The Vineyard of the Lord is Destroyed. The vineyard, of course, being Israel. We start now in Isaiah 5 by reading the first 7 verses. Isaiah begins, "I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a winepress as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I've done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it." End quote. Isaiah goes back to speaking in verse 7, "The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are the garden of his delight. And he looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress." Now the vineyard is getting trampled down. The commentators disagree on this question. Who was it? What nation trampled the vineyard? I'm going to assume it's Babylon. There are some people who say it's Assyria, but I'm going to assume it's Babylon. Isaiah starts in verse 1, "I will sing for the one I love." Who's the one that Isaiah loves? God. And Isaiah is going to sing a song. Now the song, of course, is chapter 5. Chapter 5 is totally unconnected to the previous chapter, chapter 4, or the following chapters. This is according to Adam Clark and also Albert Barnes. Ellicott says, quote, "The chapter bears every mark of being a distinct composition, perhaps the most elaborately finished in the whole of Isaiah." So we're going to take it as a unit, a single prophecy, and it is a great prophecy because Isaiah was a literary son of a gun. He could really describe things. Barnes says that the prophecy itself was probably delivered about the same time as chapters 2 and 3 were, different prophecies, but about the same time. Perhaps in Uzziah's reign from 767 to 740, nobody knows, that's just speculation. But to link this prophecy with chapters 2 and 3, we can compare some scriptures. First of all, in Isaiah 5 and Isaiah 2, man is humbled, or namely Jewish man, is humbled. Isaiah 5:15-16, humanity is brought low, man is humbled, and haughty eyes are humbled. But the Lord of hosts is exalted by his justice, and the holy God is distinguished by righteousness. We drop back to Isaiah chapter 2, and we read, "So human pride will be brought low, and the loftiness of men will be humbled. The Lord alone will be exalted on that day." So we see the humility of man and the exaltation of God in both places, so that shows that perhaps the time of the prophecies was at a close time. Doesn't prove it. We do at least see some common themes. And also the vineyard itself, that common metaphor for Israel, is seen back in Isaiah 3:14. "The Lord brings this charge against the elders and leaders of his people. You have devastated the vineyard. The plunder from the poor is in your houses." And here in our chapter in verse 1, Isaiah says, "I will sing about the one I love, a song about my loved one's vineyard," God's vineyard. The one I love, God, had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. So I'm not going to worry too much about when the prophecy was given or was it a part of another prophecy. It doesn't really matter to me. In verse 2, Isaiah says that he, referring to God, dug the vineyard up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. When he says he dug the vineyard up, other translations have it a little bit differently. The Holman Christian Study Bible says he broke up the soil. The King James and the Young's Literal Translation says that he fenced the vineyard, which is a little bit different than breaking up the soil. Perhaps that has a reference to the law. God put the law around Israel. That might be a little bit too speculative for me. This is basically a parable, and sometimes you can interpret the parable too closely and start looking for symbols in the details, making a parable walk on all fours, as is sometimes said. But at any rate, God dug up the vineyard. He cleared it of stones, because you have to clear the ground out if you're going to build a vineyard. If you want to make a symbol out of that, God cleared the vineyard of stones when he cleared out the Canaanites when Joshua invaded the land. Perhaps Isaiah is referring to that. So Isaiah dug up the vineyard, he cleared it of stones, and he planted it with the choicest vines. Perhaps that refers to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Caleb, Joshua, the great heroes and patriarchs of the Jewish faith. God built a watchtower in the vineyard. That watchtower could be Jerusalem, the capital, or the fortress of Zion. When I say the fortress of Zion, I mean the walls around that promontory of land that was called the city of David. Could be the temple itself on Mount Moriah, or it could be that Isaiah is not trying to make it symbolize anything. He's just describing the vineyard. At the end of verse 2, God looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Well, that's obvious what that means. The Israelites themselves were the bad fruit. They had sinned so much. Verse 3, now you dwellers in Jerusalem and men of Judah. And that's why I think that it's referring to the destruction of Israel, namely southern Israel, Judah, by the Babylonians, because that's who Isaiah is speaking to right now. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. Now, this verse 3 is the beginning of God speaking, Jeremiah. Isaiah is quoting God now. He's not speaking himself. He's speaking to Jerusalem and the men of Judah. And I think that indicates to me that just like the first four chapters, these prophecies are still against the southern kingdom. However, there are some commentators who disagree with that. In verse 4, God says, what more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? What greater privileges, blessings, and advantages, natural, civil, and religious, could I have done for Israel? Israel had the oracles of God, and this is what they do with it. Now, this metaphor of the vineyard is mentioned in other scriptures. Jeremiah 2:21, Jeremiah quotes God as saying this, I planted you a choice vine from the very best seed. How then could you turn into a degenerate foreign vine? Again, this vineyard is a common metaphor. And here's an interesting idea. Perhaps Jesus was referring to this himself when he gave the parable of the vineyard in Matthew 21, verse 33. Listen to another parable, Jesus said. There was a man, a landowner, who planted a vineyard, put a fence around it, dug a wine press in it, and built a watchtower. Sounds just like Isaiah, does it not? He leased it to tenant farmers and went away. Now that vineyard in the parable is referring to Israel, because when the man sent people, prophets, to collect the rent, the owners of the vineyard beat them, and then he sent his only son, and then they killed him. But the vineyard was Israel, in this case apostate Israel. Now when Yahweh complains that the fruit is only bad, that word bad doesn't really do it justice. The Hebrew word translated bad implies corrupt, rotten, and stinking. That's the kind of fruit the Israelites were. In verse 5, God continues, I will tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge. Now, vineyards back then had hedges of thorns. The Israelites would put a fence of thorns so thick around a vineyard that nobody could pass through the thorns, as Barnes says. So God will take away that hedge of thorns, which means the vineyard is totally unprotected, ready for enemies to come trample it. It will be destroyed, says God in verse 5. Now, as I said earlier, it's not clear when this destruction took place. Adam Clark says it's the Babylonian invasion, and I think that's what it is. John Gill, who seems to be hung up on the Roman invasion in AD 70, he says it's the Romans in AD 70. I don't think so. I've talked about that in previous chapters. Jameson Fawcett and Brown thinks it's the Assyrians who invaded northern Israel in 722. This is what they say. The close of the chapter alludes generally to the still distant invasion of Assyrians in a later reign. When the time drew nigh, he handles the details more particularly, namely the calamities caused by the Syro-Israelitish invasion. That's when Pekah and Rezin got together to invade Judah, and subsequently by the Assyrians whom Ahaz had invited to his help. So Jameson Fawcett Brown says the vineyard is destroyed by northern Israel, by Syria, by the Assyrians. Well, I would come against that by saying, well, it says in verse 3 that it's Jerusalem and Judah who are being referred to. Verse 3, now you dwellers in Jerusalem and men of Judah, that's not the northern kingdom, that's the southern kingdom. And while the southern kingdom was afflicted by the Syrians and the northern kingdom, what I just say is Babylon. And so that's what we're going to do. Now in verse 5, not only is the hedge taken away, but the wall of the vineyard is broken down. Apparently, vineyards back then had a hedge and a wall, a double enclosure. the wall perhaps made out of rammed earth or stones or something. But whatever it was, it's torn down because God is ready for judgment to come on his vineyard. We go down to Isaiah 5, verses 8 through 10. Isaiah continues to speak, "Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there is no more room and you alone are left in the land. I heard the Lord of hosts say." Now we go to what God is saying. "Indeed, many houses will become desolate, grand and lovely ones without inhabitants. For a 10-acre vineyard will yield only 6 gallons, and 10 bushels of seed will yield only 1 bushel. Now in verse 8, Isaiah says, "Woe to you who add house to house." Well, there's nothing wrong with buying houses and fields, but it's the insatiable lust for housing and fields that Isaiah is condemning here. "Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field, until the person who does that is all alone left in the land." The reason he's all alone is because he ends up owning every house in the land, so he's all by himself. He has no more neighbors anymore. He's bought them all out. This is a great lesson showing how lust for money and friendship are not compatible. And so God begins to speak at the end of verse 9, "Indeed, many houses will become desolate." And God is speaking all the way through the end of verse 10. God says a 10-acre field will yield only 6 gallons of wine. 10-acre is a loose translation. The literal Hebrew is a 10-yoke field, the amount of land a team of 10 oxen could plow. They didn't have acres back then. But it's obviously a fairly big field for a Hebrew farmer because there's a contrast between the size of the field, how large it is, and how small the yield of grapes are, or wine, 6 gallons. The NIV has a Bath Home of Christian Study Bible, gives us the English units as 6 gallons. The point is things are going to be quite non-productive in Israel after the desolation comes. 10 bushels of seed will yield only 1 bushel. You plant 10 bushels of seed and only get 1 bushel of crop back, that's pretty bad crop yield. It's usually the other way around. 10 times as much seed is planted as grain was harvested. Pretty bad. The NIV has 1 homer is planted and 1 bushel, 1 ephah is harvested. For those of you who like Hebrew dry measures, Bath is a liquid measure. Homer and ephah are dry measures. I can't ever remember how much they were, so I just get the Home of Christian Study Bible out and let them do the conversions for me. We go now to Isaiah 5, verses 11 through 17. God continues, "Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they are inflamed with wine. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, tambourines and flutes and wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the work of his hands. Therefore my people will go into exile for lack of understanding. Their men of rank will die of hunger, and their masses will be parched with thirst. Therefore the grave enlarges its appetite and opens its mouth without limit. Into it will descend their nobles and masses with all their brawlers and revelers. So man will be brought low and mankind humbled, the eyes of the arrogant humbled. But the Lord Almighty will be exalted by his justice, and the holy God will show himself holy by his righteousness. Then sheep will graze as in their own pasture. Lambs will feed among the ruins of the rich." Verse 11, God says, "Woe to those who rise early in the morning." One's got to be pretty dissipated to start drinking early in the morning. In fact, this idea is conveyed in Ecclesiastes 10, verses 16 through 17 by Solomon. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 10, verses 16 through 17, "Woe to you, land, when your king is a youth and your princes feast in the morning." It's not the time for princes to be feasting in the morning. That's a nighttime activity. "Blessed are you, land," Solomon continues, "when your king is a son of nobles and your princes feast at the proper time." That would be nighttime. "For strength and not for drunkenness." Somebody that gets drunk in the morning is a lush. Go now to Acts 2, verses 14 through 15. "But Peter stood up with the 11, raised his voice, and proclaimed to them," this is at Pentecost, "Men of Judah and all you residents of Jerusalem, let me explain to you, he's talking about all the people filled with the Holy Spirit and staggering around, speaking in other tongues. "Let me explain this to you and pay attention to my words, for these people are not drunk, as you suppose, since it's only 9 a.m. What Peter is saying is, people don't drink at 9 a.m. That's not normal. But in verse 11 of Isaiah 5, God says that the people of Israel are doing that. rising early up in the morning. And not only that, they drink in the morning, they stay up all day to late at night. They're inflamed with wine. They've been drinking all day. They have harps and lyres at their banquets. Harps and lyres are hard to distinguish. They're both stringed instruments. A harp is big. It looks something like our harp today, and it's planted on the ground. A lyre is held in the lap. It's a stringed instrument. There's a base at the bottom from which two elongated pieces of wood stick up, sometimes looking like parentheses, sometimes like rabbit ears. And then there's a cross piece at the top of those two projections, and then strings are strung from the cross piece down to the base, and it's plucked like a harp, but it's in the lap. It's kind of like a lap harp. These are standard musical instruments back then in Israel's time. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, tambourines and flutes, two more common instruments, and there's wine again. But they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord. What deeds? Well, it could be the deeds of creation, the deeds of providence and history, the history of Israel. It could be the law. It could be the carrying of the 10 northern tribes into captivity. If chapter 5 here is referring to the Babylonian captivity, God continues, these people have no respect for the work of God's hands, which is the same thing as his deeds. Verse 13, therefore my people will go into exile. I'm assuming it's the Babylonian exile in 586 BC for lack of understanding. That means not rational understanding, but for understanding what God's plan and purposes and law is. Their men of rank will die of hunger, and their masses will be parched with thirst. Let's read about some of the hunger in the Babylonian exile. Jeremiah 52:6. By the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine was so severe in the city that the people of the land had no food. They were out. Severe famine. And then Jeremiah writes about this famine in Jerusalem after the exile. Lamentations 4:4, second part of the verse, to verse 5. Little children beg for bread, says Jeremiah, but no one gives them any. Those who used to eat delicacies are destitute in the streets. Those who were reared in purple garments huddle in garbage heaps. Lamentations chapter 4, verses 9 through 10. Jeremiah says this, those slain by the sword are better off than those slain by hunger, who waste away, pierced with pain because the fields lack produce. The hands of compassionate women have cooked their own children. They became their food during the destruction of my dear people. And of course, Lamentations is written about the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem, and this is what was left behind. Isaiah predicted it in advance, if this is indeed which disaster he is predicting, and I think it is. Their masses will be parched with thirst. Notice that Isaiah contrasts in verse 13, the men of rank, people at the top, with their masses, the common people. Doesn't make any difference. Everybody's going to be hungry, and everybody's going to be thirsty. Lamentations 4, verse 4, first part of the verse says, the nursing infant's tongue clings to the roof of his mouth from thirst. His mother's breast is dried up, because she doesn't have any water either. In verse 14, God says, therefore the grave enlarges its appetite and opens its mouth without limit. That sounds like a mass grave. It sounds like somebody's dug a pit. Because the number of the dead was so great that the common burying places were not sufficient to hold the dead. And so some vast, prodigious pit had to be dug. And into this pit go the nobles, the masses, the brawlers, the revelers. Verse 15, so man would be brought low and mankind humbled, the eyes of the arrogant humbled, and that's usually what happens before people are destroyed. They're arrogant. They're too stupid to see what's coming. In contrast to that, in verse 16, the Lord Almighty will be exalted by his justice. It will be a just thing for Israel to go down because of all of its sin. The holy God will show himself holy by his righteousness. Holy means, of course, separated from this profane, sinful world. He will show himself holy by his righteousness. Righteousness just means justice. It will be just for the Israelites to be judged. This concept of justice and righteousness and the wrath of God is, of course, completely or almost completely alien to the evangelical church today in America today. It's certainly alien to the people of America who are partying on the edge of the canyon that's going to devour them when the judgment finally comes on the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 17, God says, then sheep will graze as in their own pasture. Lambs will feed among the ruins of the rich. What that means is as the houses are torn down and destroyed, the grass will grow amongst the ruins, and so the lambs will have something to eat. But the people will have their houses ruined, these formerly rich people, the ruins of the rich. We go now to Isaiah 5, verses 18 through 19. Isaiah continues, "Woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness as with cart ropes, to those who say, 'Let God hurry, let him hasten his work so we may see it. Let it approach, let the plan of the Holy One of Israel come so we may know it.'" What Isaiah is saying here is that these evil people have tied sin to them with ropes. They tie themselves to their sin and they drag it along behind them so that wherever they go, their sin is obvious right behind them. And their sin is characterized by deceit. I presume that means they're deceiving themselves. Maybe they're deceiving other people. Wickedness is with cart rope, same idea. Wickedness is tied behind them. They drag it around. Isaiah says in verse 19, these are people who say, "Let God hurry, let him hasten his work." Now, what Isaiah is referring to here is sinners mocking God. "Oh, Isaiah, you're prophesying that judgment is coming? What kind of an idiot are you? God's not going to do any judgment." So then Isaiah's enemies, the evil people, start getting sarcastic. So they say, "Come on, let God, let's see what God can do. Let God bring it on. The Holy One of Israel that you keep talking about, let his plan be carried out so we may know it. We don't know it now, and we're never going to know it because God's not going to judge this nation." That sound familiar? That's exactly how sinners think. The sinners called God the Holy One of Israel, but they were being sarcastic and ironic about it. We go now to verses 20 through 25. In Isaiah 5, Isaiah continues, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions at mixing drinks, who acquit the guilty for a bribe, but deny justice to the innocent. Therefore, as tongues of fire lick up straw and as dry grass sinks down to the flames, so their roots will decay and their flowers blow away like dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord Almighty and spurned the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, the Lord's anger burns against his people. His hand is raised and he strikes them down. The mountains shake and the dead bodies are like refuse in the streets. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised." Now, starting in verse 20, God is talking about the moral inversion that the Israelites have carried about. Evil is good, good is evil, just like we have in America. "You're trying to stop the murder of human beings in their womb? Well, you hate women. You are an evil person. You should have your pro-life centers attacked. Who put darkness for light and light for darkness. Oh, this person's robbed and raped and killed. Well, we need to turn him loose without bail. He hasn't really done anything wrong. It's society's fault that he's ended up this way." These people now, just as back then in verse 21, are wise in their own eyes and they're clever in their own sight. They think they know everything. But God says in verse 22, "Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine." In other words, they can hold their liquor. They're better at drinking wine than at fighting wars because they're cowards when it comes to being a soldier. But boy, there are heroes at a banquet. They're champions at mixing drinks. Reminds me of fraternities in colleges. 20, 21, 22, 18, 19-year-old fools drinking themselves, many of whom are dying as they fall out of balconies or get into a car and kill somebody else, or they rape some girl. Of course, the girls are just as stupid there in their sororities getting drunk and getting raped. Yeah, those are some heroes, all right. Verse 23, "They acquit the guilty for a bribe." Of course, the justice system is the first thing that goes down when righteousness is trampled upon. No justice for the innocent. And I can't say this more emphatically as an ex-lawyer. I realize how important it is to have a just legal system, because when you don't, awful things happen to innocent people. Even with a perfect system, justice is not going to be perfect because it's a human system. But when it is corrupt, when that system is corrupt, people are just treated horribly and denied basic rights as a human being. Verse 24, God says, "Therefore, as tongues of fire lick up straw," the straw goes very quickly when that happens. If you've ever lit straw with a match, you've seen that. The straw disappears very quickly. "Dry grass sinks down in the flames." Likewise, you got dry grass, light it, boom, it's gone. Likewise, these wicked people are going to be gone very quickly. The metaphor is switched here. God says their roots will decay and their flowers blow away like dust, because a flower without a root is a dead flower. It becomes very brittle. You thump it with your finger, and it turns into dust. That's what's going to happen to these people. For they have rejected the law of the Lord, spurned the word of the Holy One of Israel. Verse 25, therefore the Lord's anger burns against his people. His hand is raised, and he strikes them down. His people, referring to the Jews. Now that's a generic reference. That's not talking about people who actually loved the Lord personally. There were a few, Jeremiah, for example. It's talking about the nation of Israel he struck down, most of whom were unregenerate sinners. The true people of God are not destined for wrath. At the end of verse 25, Isaiah says, the mountains shake. Now, of course, this is decreation rhetoric, earthquakes in the mountains. Whenever you see rhetoric like that, you're talking about regime change. There's a nation or an empire going down. We'll see that. For example, in Isaiah 13, Babylon is going to go down, and we see the moon turn into blood and the sun getting dark and the stars falling from skies like figs. The mountains shake and the dead bodies are like refuse in the streets. So many dead bodies, not enough time to bury them all. Of course, that spreads disease, plague. But God's not finished with them yet. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. God is extremely angry. This illustrates a principle too much. To those whom much has been given, much is required. And the Jews, they had the prophecies, they had the law, they had all these things that the pagans around them did not have, and they just spit in God's face. You sin against God knowingly, you sin against a great light, the judgment is going to be extremely severe. Think about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. They were innocent, they had no temptations except when the devil came. They had no flesh urging them to yield to the temptations of the devil. They walked with God face to face. I believe that was Jesus in human form in the garden. They were living in, after all, what was called paradise, the Garden of Eden. They had it made, but then they sinned. And look what happened, the fall of mankind and all the evils that have come since then. It is a terrible thing to sin against God when you have a clear vision of him. A terrible thing. We go now to Isaiah 5, verses 26 through 30, and we'll finish this chapter. Isaiah continues, he, referring to God, lifts up a banner for the distant nations. He whistles for those at the ends of the earth. Here they come, swiftly and speedily. Not one of them grows tired or stumbles. Not one slumbers or sleeps. Not a belt is loosened at the waist. Not a sandal thong is broken. Their arrows are sharp. All their bows are strung. Their horses' hoofs seem like flint. Their chariot wheels like a whirlwind. Their roar is like that of the lion. They roar like young lions. They growl as they seize their prey and carry it off with no one to rescue. In that day they will roar over it like the roaring of the sea. And if one looks at the land, he will see darkness and distress. Even the light will be darkened by the clouds. In verse 26, God is going to lift up a banner for the distant nations. We have a problem there. Why nations? Why plural? Option number one is because the invading empire is composed of many constituent nations. John Gill says the invading empire is Rome. I say it's Babylon. So does Adam Clark. The pulpit commentator says it's Assyria. So there's a split of opinion on that, but whichever empire it is that's invading would have constituent nations within that empire, and that would explain the plural. I've got another idea. Perhaps Isaiah here is referring to successive judgments, Assyria first in 722 and Babylon in 586 B.C. He lifts up a banner for the distant nations because there's going to be two nations coming in. Now, to back this idea up, we can look at Isaiah 5:3 in this chapter. So now residents of Jerusalem and men of Judah. And so Isaiah is referring to the southern kingdom there, referring to judgment on Jerusalem, the southern kingdom from Babylon. We would say, we would argue, and then in verse 7 of chapter 5, we read this, for the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. One could say that Israel is referring to the northern 10 tribes and the men of Judah. House of Israel, the north, the men of Judah, the south, and then he describes the injustice and so forth that's there, and he refers to the judgment there, so the argument would go on northern Israel from Assyria and southern Israel from Babylon. Well, that argument is a little bit weak because in verse 7, when Isaiah says, for the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, Israel sometimes refers to Judah. not necessarily the northern 10 tribes. So it's not perfectly clear. Let me give you what I think is a better solution. This is from the Cambridge commentary. That commentary says that nations there should be single. He lifts up a banner for the distant nation. Let me quote from the Cambridge commentary. Better a nation from afar. The singular is demanded by what follows and is obtained by removing the last letter of one word to the beginning of the next, exactly as is done in Jeremiah 5:15. Well, that goes to the Hebrew, and I don't know Hebrew, and none of my other commentators noticed this, but it makes sense to me. So we're going to say he lifts up a banner for the distant nation of Babylon. Why does he lift up a banner? So that Babylon can see it. It's like, here it is, come get it. This is Jerusalem. His banner over Israel would not be love, but would be judgment in that case. At the end of verse 26, God whistles for those at the ends of the earth. The ends of the earth, of course, would be Babylon. The ends of the land might be a better translation. Earth can always be translated as land. And God whistles for them. Now, that word for whistles can also be translated as hiss, as the KJV has it. Adam Clark quotes one of his commentators, who says this, quote, the metaphor is taken from the practice of those that keep bees, who draw them out of their hives into the fields and lead them back again by a hiss or a whistle. And so God is whistling, come here, Babylonians, let's wipe out this vineyard of mine. Here they come, swiftly and speedily, he says in verse 26 at the end. And then in verse 27, God says, not one of them grows tired of stumbles. Actually, that's Isaiah saying that. Not one of them grows tired or stumbles. Not one slumbers asleep. In other words, these soldiers are on a fast march, a forced march. They're coming fast. Not a belt is loosened. In other words, they don't loosen their clothes to eat or to sleep. They just keep coming. Not a sandal thong is broken. Likewise, they don't take their shoes off. They just keep right on coming. Their arrows are sharp, or their bows are strung. Their horses' hoofs seem like flint. Flint, of course, is very hard, so the horse's hoofs are not worn out or hurt. I used to have a horse. The fingernails get long. They split. That's why people have invented horseshoes to put on the bottom of a horse's hoof so that the hoofs don't get wrecked. Well, these Babylonian horses have hooves like flint because they are ready for war. Their chariot wheels come like a whirlwind, spinning around very fast like a fan blowing a whirlwind. Their roar is like that of the lion. The Babylonians come in, they roar like young lions. A young lion might perhaps be more deadly than an old lion. Maybe that's why a young lion is mentioned. Actually, the Hebrew for lion there is lioness, according to a couple of my commentaries, which might mean that a lioness is more deadly than a lion. The Hebrews apparently regarded lionesses as fiercer than lions, which makes sense if a lioness is trying to guard her young lions. The Babylonians come and they growl just like these lions do. When lions seize their prey and carry their prey off with no one to rescue, growling as they go, reminds me of my cat when she used to chase mice. She's growling as she drags that mouse around. She's so proud of it. Verse 30, in that day they will roar over it like the roaring of the sea. The lions roar over the dead bodies. The Babylonians are roaring over the dead Israelites. And it sounds like ocean waves roaring. And if one looks at the land, he will see darkness and distress. Even the light will be darkened by the clouds. Everything's dark. Oh, there's a little bit of sunshine peeking through the clouds. Oops, now it's covered up again because the clouds have covered up the light because there is no light in Israel. Israel is toast. Israel is kaputsky. On that pleasant note, we are now finished with Isaiah chapter 5. We are now ready to go to Isaiah chapter 6. This is a famous chapter of Isaiah. I will entitle it Isaiah's Vision of the Lord. Hope to see you in chapter 6, and hope you enjoyed this audio.